Few things today seem to make us as anxious as the rise of technology. From the development of terrifying weapons of war to worries about the devices that we use every single day, it seems we find new reasons to fear technological advances with each passing hour. Which is why I wanted to revisit the work of the legendary British writer Aldous Huxley, who had a unique and nuanced view of technology. He was both an enthusiast about the good that new technology could bring to humankind, and was grimly aware of the horrifying effects that it could have if it were used unwisely, or if a technocratic elite abused their superior power to keep the rest of us under their thumb, possibly with our unthinking consent. As always, I'll be unable to cover the full depth of Huxley's thinking here, and we also ought not to take his word as gospel. Rather, we can use him to ask our own questions about how we want technology to be approached today. After all, for better or for worse, the future is in our hands and not Huxley's. My name is Joe Folley, and this is Unsolicited Advice. But first, if you want reliable news coverage on the latest technological advances, as well as everything else, then you should check out today's very kind sponsor, Ground News. Ground News is a website and app that gathers related articles from thousands of sources around the world in a single place so that you can compare how different outlets cover the same story. Each story comes with a clear breakdown of the political bias, factuality, ownership, and headlines of the reporting sources, with ratings backed by independent news monitoring organizations. Ground News are very kindly offering anyone who uses my link or scans my QR code 40% off their Vantage plan as a special deal, and this is the plan that I use, so I highly encourage you to snap that up. For instance, let's see how left and right-wing publications differed on a rather bizarre story, the White House releasing an image of President Trump dressed as a pope. While left-wing sources were heavily critical, arguing that this was intensely disrespectful, right-wing sources portrayed it as a light-hearted joke and argued that this would not affect any Catholic support. I especially like the Blind Spots feed, which highlights stories that are disproportionately covered by the left or the right and ignored by the other side. This feed helps readers step into the other side's news reality and understand the different narratives that can shape their beliefs, such as left-wing sources missing allegations concerning a cover-up of Biden's health concerns, or right-wing sources missing lawsuits filed against the Trump administration and RFK Jr. over health cuts. I just don't have a lot of time to keep up with the news, and certainly not to examine every article I read for bias. So receiving my Ground News roundup at the end of every day means that I can get a variety of news opinions, learn which sources are trustworthy, and make the world less of a bewildering mess. Ground News are giving my viewers 40% off their unlimited access Vantage plan. They've genuinely become my go-to news source. I cannot recommend them highly enough, and I really hope that you'll check them out. But anyway, back to the video. 1. The dark side of ease. Maybe Huxley's most unsettling vision of the future of technology comes in his Brave New World. I have a full video on the concept of pleasure in that story, but something I did not discuss in too much detail there is Huxley's concern that technology specifically will eventually begin to edge out some of the most fulfilling and meaningful parts of a human life. To recap incredibly briefly, Brave New World follows a series of characters as they navigate this techno-futuristic dystopia where people are much happier than they are today, but this comes at the severe cost of central aspects of their humanity. People are happy in their state-assigned station because they've been conditioned to view that as their place. Whenever someone feels sad, they take a drug called Soma, which both dulls their unhappiness and provides them with a temporary high. And the population at large is placated with a constant barrage of entertainment. At each step along the way, Huxley demonstrates how technology might be used to rob us of those aspects of ourselves that we most hold dear, and perhaps even more insidiously, that we might consent to this. Take friendship or love, for example. In their traditional sense, these things simply do not exist in Brave New World, because they're inconvenient, both from the perspective of the person and of the state. Everyone is said to belong to everyone else, And this new vision of the world is facilitated through enormous technological advances taken by the state. People don't really need one another anymore because they don't feel loneliness or distress because of the substances they're taking and the conditioning they've undergone. Paradoxically, this has made the Society of Brave New World both deeply collectivist, in the sense that there is no such thing as private property or anything like that, but also deeply individualistic, in that there are no concrete links between individual people. People don't care about one another. There is no such thing as wishing the good of the other for their own sake, to use Aristotle's terminology around friendship, or of feeling the kind of love that makes you prefer one person to another, or to place them above even yourself. But this limits people to an immensely shallow kind of joy. Sure, they are happy in a certain sense, but it's the kind of happiness of watching a funny program on the telly. There's nothing inherently wrong with this. I quite enjoy a funny program on the telly. But would you really want your life to consist in just this kind of pleasure, as opposed to, say, the pleasure of having a late-night conversation with a trusted friend, one that's made all the sweeter by the knowledge that you were bound together by mutual bonds of trust, affection, and indeed preference? Huxley suggests that there is much more to life than the kind of pleasure on offer in Brave New World, but he also worries that we will fall under the spell of convenience and never even realize what we're missing out on. Another good example of lost humanity in Brave New World is the arena of thought. Huxley has a complex relationship with the idea of reflective thought and learning. On the one hand, he does recognize it as an immensely valuable part of the human mind and the human experience. In his semi-utopian novel, The Island, where he lays out a more optimistic vision for humanity, he places education and learning at its forefront. His essay, Educating the Amphibian, is all about the ability of learning to not just come in handy, but to enrich the very experience of our lives. And he argues that education should be broadened from mere textbooks and facts to learning how to appreciate the world in every sense of the word. For Huxley, learning and thought is not just about practicalities, but a sort of whole cultivation of mind, body, and spirit as he sees it, and we'll definitely be coming back to this in the later sections. However, Huxley also recognized a pretty unpleasant truth about learning, critical thought, and all of the other things that people wearing bow ties seem inordinately fond of. They can also be hard, boring, and seem pointless at times. As a result, he thinks that we humans are absolutely begging for distraction. He puts this incredibly well in one essay on propaganda. There, he's commenting on our failure to predict the rise of empty entertainment, and he says the following. They failed to foresee the development of a vast mass communications industry, concerned in the main neither with the true nor the false, but with the unreal, the more or less totally irrelevant. In a word, they failed to take into account man's almost infinite appetite for distractions. Now, I do think there is a danger that we can step into old man shouts at cloud territory here. Maybe I'm biased, but I quite like some empty entertainment now and then. Life cannot just exist of deep thoughts and ardent struggle. But I think this hits upon a very similar pattern to Huxley's point regarding friendship and love. Namely, that because of our natural desire for comfort, we can voluntarily give up something incredibly valuable because there's no longer a negative force compelling us to do it. In Brave New World, and increasingly in our own, we are often not forced to think, and Huxley thinks we will increasingly be able to outsource our thinking to technology. Personally, I think this may be one of the scarier potential uses for large language models. My worry with AI writing, for example, is not that it's always ugly prose, but rather because the process of writing helps you discover what you think about something. It forces you to get your thoughts in order, and it also helps you realize when something you thought was insightful turns out to be banal or just plain false. I can't tell you how many times that's happened to me when writing one of these scripts. And one distinctive aspect of Huxley's worries for technology is that not only will we let this happen, but we won't even mind this happening. On the one hand, this makes it significantly less nightmarish than, say, 1984. Given the choice, I would much rather live in an unfree society that bribes me with pleasure and entertainment than one that hauls me off to the Ministry of Truth to get a lecture on psychoanalysis by a therapist-stroke-torturer before having my face devoured by rats. But It is by its very pleasantness that Huxley's vision for technology is so disturbing. If our respective governments suddenly became outright tyrannical, they might face some pretty stiff resistance from a population that prefers democracy to the rat-eating face brigade. On the other hand, if it were genuinely enjoyable and promised a lifetime of empty pleasures, would we be so keen to resist? Even though I'm slightly ashamed to admit it, I know it would be much easier to talk me round. Perhaps the most well-known analysis of Huxley on this point comes from Neil Postman in his famous essay, Amusing Ourselves to Death. Here, he talks of the Huxleyan warning for the future of democracies, and I'm going to read directly from his essay because it is better put than anything that I could say. In the Huxleyan prophecy, Big Brother does not watch us by his choice. We watch him by ours. There is no need for wardens or gates or ministries of truth. When a population becomes distracted by trivia, when cultural life is redefined as a perpetual round of entertainments, when serious public conversation becomes a form of baby talk, when, in short, a people become an audience and their public business a vaudeville act, then a nation finds itself at risk. The idea here is not that we will become oppressed by technology in the traditional sense. Huxley does not envision a totalitarian state suddenly imposing all of this from above. But rather, we would gradually agree to all of this because it makes our lives that bit more convenient and that bit more entertaining. We will be so lost in the pleasurable advantages that we won't even notice our own agency slipping away. And put a pin in this idea of agency, as it will be very important both in the next section and all throughout the later part of the video. And contained within this thought is a warning for how we approach new technology. Huxley cautions us against simply embracing a new technological advance because it makes our lives easier or more convenient. It could be that after careful consideration, it truly is a wonderful innovation, and we'll be looking at the positive things that Huxley thinks technology can do later in the video. However, we might also be making a Faustian pact and trading in some deeper, more precious aspect of ourselves for the sake of a little temporary pleasure. But this is only one part of Huxley's technological analysis. He is just as concerned with what might be described as technological progress for progress's sake. 2. An order of priorities. It's difficult to quite put your finger on one central thought behind the anxiety surrounding technology, but the sense that I get from many of them is the worry that we'll begin to sacrifice human goods for the sake of technological progress. And this is totally understandable. The glorification of technological progression as an end in itself is pretty nerve-wracking, partly because it sort of de-centers humanity from our moral concerns and could start to make us merely a cog in a wider machine. Again, Brave New World is the paradigm case for this. There, technology is primarily used as a means to control the populace and subject them to the whims of a few controllers who almost view the people themselves as technological, that is, as a means to the end of further progress. By the time that we set foot into this world, the process is almost complete, with only a few stragglers and troublesome free thinkers standing between the benevolent overlords and total domination. It bears a passing resemblance to what Heidegger called the technological mode of revealing. Now, reading Heidegger is a little bit like attempting to decipher the proclamations of an incredibly clever mystical prophet, and as a result, there is huge divergence on what exactly Heidegger meant by this technological mode and what its consequences would be. But to massively oversimplify for the purposes of this video, we can think of it as a grand instrumentalization, where everything, even human beings, are repurposed as tools or resources. Rather than technology being the tool by which we achieve some greater end, the end becomes the creation of greater and greater tools. The world and everything in it, be it inanimate, animal, or human, is a resource to be drawn from. Heidegger seems to think that this is somewhat inherent in our approach to modern technology, but Huxley is a little less apocalyptic in his predictions. If the difference between the use of technology in Brave New World and in The Island could be summed up in a single sentence, it would probably be this. In The Island, technology exists to serve human ends, whereas in Brave New World, humans themselves are seen as merely another technological resource for the state to use. This attitude heavily affects the way the two nations approach industry, psychological innovations, and even the very structure of their societies and their ethical priorities. In Pala, the state in the island, they take a pretty unorthodox approach to industrialization. They have an extremely gradualist strategy, where they keep a close eye on the effects of industry on the lives of the everyday citizen. In some ways, this puts them at an international disadvantage. They are not a very powerful state, and the incoming constitutional monarch points out that they would be much richer as a nation if they properly and systematically industrialized. Undoubtedly, this is true. But the existing government of Pala worries about the negative effects of any sudden and uncontrolled technological growth. Would the people of the island really be happier in an industrialized nation, or would their more modest technology, where most advances are in medicine or psychology, serve the average citizen better? Look, clearly Huxley himself is against rapid industrialization. And to be honest, I don't know enough about economics or politics to know whether he is right or absolutely wrong. But I want to focus instead on the thought process the government of Pala undertook. They asked whether their technological policy would best serve their citizens, rather than considering progress good for its own sake. Likewise, they have a village-based living arrangement, where children are raised in communities of 20 or more people, without dissolving the initial family unit. Any widespread economic change would almost certainly disrupt this, and the government takes this into account. This person-centered approach to industrialization does not mean that they will always remain against the total mobilization of their economy, even if Huxley probably would be. Rather, it means that they would only do this if they thought it served the interests of their citizens, and if the citizens themselves desired it. Contrast this to Brave New World, where each person is seen as simply a cog in the ever-developing world state. Sure, they might be relatively well taken care of, but their agency is not taken into account in the slightest. Gene editing is used to ensure that each person knows their place, and there is no such thing as an independently developed will. Whereas the island is concerned with what their citizens want, Brave New World is only concerned with what they think is best for the state, without consulting the citizens at all. While the controllers like Mustafa Mond are convinced that they are working on behalf of the citizenry, they only really view them as resources to exploit. It's just that they're not exploiting them for their own benefit, but for the state's. Sure, this is certainly a step up from a self-interested dictator, but it still treats humanity, as Kant might put it, as a means to an end, rather than as an end in itself. It places humans on the same moral plane as any other natural resource. In Brave New World, we are just coal that can think. This also extends to what we might call psychological technology. That is, scientific progress in understanding how we think, act, and feel. We don't often talk about this as technology, but some of our most visible technological advances rely on this underlying psychological knowledge. Social media apps, for example, use recent innovations in attention science to keep us hooked on their platforms for a long time. I say, throwing stones from my incredibly glass house. Understanding how fear, ambition, and lust work has helped create huge leaps forward in advertising, which then fuels further technological progress. And again, we see that the fundamental difference between Brave New World and the island is whether the human being is considered as an agent whose individual wishes are worth taking into account, or whether they are merely a tool for the government to use. In Brave New World, a mixture of futuristic hypnosis and the aforementioned drug Soma are used to prevent the populace from even considering what they would want, and to ensure that they remain totally in line with the will of the world controllers. The controllers justify this by saying that it prevents social conflict. But again, this comes at the cost of human agency. It is a deeply condescending view, where the controllers assume that they know what's best for every individual person without ever consulting them on the matter. By contrast, in the island, the society's psychological innovations are not used to coerce the wills of the citizens in a fixed direction, but mostly to facilitate the citizens' own thinking. Huxley was heavily influenced by certain mind-expanding substances that he had taken, and this forms part of the therapeutic approach in parlor. But again, the specifics are less important than the general ethos behind them. In the psychological ethic of parlor, the human agent is considered a source of value in themselves, and their will is viewed as intrinsically important so long as they are not using it to override the wills of others. Thus, they use their knowledge of the human mind not to make people conform to what the elite upper classes assume is best, but rather to ensure that each individual person can think, consider, and create to the best of their abilities. Huxley doesn't think that this will lead to a society of hyper-individualists who care about nothing else but their own thoughts. He just thinks it will help people form communities with the right balance between service to the group and respect for individual wishes. This also reflects a more general worry that Huxley had about the different ways technology could alter the power dynamics in a society. Advanced technology can be used as a way to control others, and at its most extreme, psychological technology can be used to control our very minds and alter our very wills. And chances are, we will not have equal access to such technology. So, it potentially creates quite a stark power differential. The world controllers have consciously monopolized the technological power in their state, and in doing so, have monopolized the mind of the nation. By contrast, Parler's human-first approach ensures that the benefits of technology are distributed to as many as possible, which then prevents the development of a technologically superior overclass that can rule over the rest of us, maybe without us even realizing. And I want to explore this point about power more deeply. Because in some ways, Huxley is gravely concerned about how technology can lead to a gradual stratification of society, where we are each kept in our place by the all-powerful hand of technological superiority. If you want to help me make more videos like this, then please do consider signing up to my Patreon to get access to very occasional exclusive content. But honestly, it's no pressure, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the video. 3. Technology and power. When the atomic bomb was invented, the world changed permanently. All of a sudden, there was a brand new way to devastate entire cities, and a dividing line was drawn between those nations who had an atom bomb and those who did not. From that moment forward, in order to be a major player on the military stage, you had to have one of these terrifying weapons. Instantly, there was a sharp distinction between nuclear nations and non-nuclear ones. And you could be pretty sure that a non-nuclear nation was never going to dominate a nuclear one. And this reflects a general propensity in certain technological advances. They can begin to open up huge discrepancies in power between those with the technology and those without it. Sometimes this control is a very good thing. I'm not convinced it would be helpful to democratize the use of military drones or of tanks. But at the same time, Huxley is deeply concerned about how a few people with access to extraordinary technology could keep a great mass of people without it in check. The classic example of this is Jeremy Bentham's Panopticon. This is a circular prison where every prisoner can be watched by a single guard from a central platform. Often this is used to illustrate the chilling effects of being watched. Since no prisoner knows when he is under observation, each one has to constantly act as if they are at all times, thus controlling their behavior from within. But just as important is the discrepancy in numbers. The prisoners are many and the guard is one, but through this new technology, the guard can control the prisoners with ease. In Brave New World, this use of technology manifests in the total depoliticization of the citizens. As we said in the previous section, the world is governed by controllers, who ensure that the populace is kept happy and placated. Technology here is used as a kind of catch-all political solution. If someone is miserable or discontented, they are given a soma. If someone just doesn't fit with their assigned role, they are either corrected by some kind of medical intervention, or they're sent off to live in exile with the others who refuse to play ball. Technology is employed to bypass the coordination of people by traditional means. This can sound a little bit abstract, but it's pretty intuitive. In our world, if we want to coordinate a large group of people, we need to persuade them in some way. Sure, people might turn to manipulative means to do so, but they still need to talk to them and try to convince them that their way is best. In Brave New World, they simply use one of their myriad technological advances to force people to change their minds. People are consciously conditioned from infancy to value certain things, to behave in certain ways, and to fall into set, predefined roles. There is no room for social mobility or for dissenting views. Society is divided into different strata, with the world controllers at the very top. And every tool in the state arsenal is used to prevent any change. This is, in effect, the total death of the public realm. The public realm is a concept in the philosophy of Hannah Arendt. As always, it's a bit more complicated than I'm presenting it here, but it essentially refers to our interactions with one another as free beings on an equal footing. Conversations between friends are part of the public realm, as are political debates or freely associating organizations. It's where we come together and work out what we're going to do with this world we inhabit. It's the public square or the town hall or the local Amdram society putting on a slightly half-baked production of Romeo and Juliet. It's also the foundation for any kind of democracy, or even just public participation in politics. In order for us to decide how we want our society to look, we need access to one another in this public realm. We can think about it this way. If we only ever encountered one another at work, where we had a job to focus on, or only encountered our own family, which is too small to coordinate large-scale action, how would we ever have conversations about the larger direction we want our communities to take? Hannah Arendt is already worried about the disappearance of the public realm when she wrote The Human Condition. In Brave New World, this reaches its extreme endpoint. The technological domination of the controllers means that no one ever wants to enter the public realm. And even if they wanted to, they still couldn't. Perhaps more worryingly, all resistance is completely futile. Since even if you could get a few rebels together, there would be no way to get through to the soma-addicted populace. In fact, and spoiler alert, this is what happens in the novel. Our band of protagonists get nowhere in their feeble attempt to even have a different outlook to the state. They are carted off to a pleasant exile where they cannot cause any more trouble. There is no public realm, and there isn't even a private realm. There is only the realm of the state, which uses their technology to dominate the other realms with ease. This would be basically impossible without their access to these tools. Huxley does worry that technological progress could distort the public realm and make the average person totally unable to engage with their political system. In this case, Brave New World might actually be the least of our concerns. At least there, the world controllers are simply condescending rather than outright tyrannical. Again, we see a significant contrast with the island, where technology is used to encourage the public realm. Parler's main use for its incredibly advanced education system seems to be to prevent the development of tyrants and to safeguard the democratic system that it views as so very valuable. They train their children to be skeptics, so that they would not become swept up in dogmatic rhetoric should it ever appear. Each person is encouraged to take their place in the public realm and to give their viewpoint, but also to respect the wishes of other people. It's not that there is no conflict, but social conflict is seen as a means to eventual cooperation, rather than a quest to dominate someone. And it's worth noting that this too is only possible because of the Parlanese advancements in psychological technology. The government of Parler could have easily used their extreme understanding of indoctrination to form legions of obedient and placated citizens. Who knows? They might one day become corrupted and decide to do so. That is the risk of having such tools available. Perhaps this approach is best summed up in the following quote from one of Huxley's other essays. "The aim of the educator in spiritual insight is to teach the statistically normal that they are in fact insane and should do something about it." Huxley and the government of Parler want us to bear in mind that what has always been done or is done by the majority can still be badly misguided, hence their emphasis on independent thought. This demonstrates something that will become extremely important in the next section. Huxley is not a Luddite, but nor is he a technocrat. Huxley also thinks that a proper use of educational technology could safeguard the public realm. The starkest example of this are the birds that roam the island. Each one has been trained to call out attention, to remind the Polynese people not to sleepwalk through life. This ties into Huxley's more spiritual ideas about paying attention to your immediate experience, but it also reflects the general public attitude on Pala, to remain alert and awake, under the sway of neither despots nor dogmas. It helps to create citizens that don't just think for themselves, but are openly willing and able to contribute those thoughts to a wider community that they deeply and freely identify with. Again, we see a contrast between domination by technology and cooperation using technology. This is especially important because, with sufficient technological advances, it becomes almost impossible to actually work against a tyrannical government. As in Orwell's 1984, technology can create total surveillance and the extreme monopolization of power in the hands of a tiny minority of people. Short of spontaneous, total resistance by everyone else, basically nothing could overthrow Big Brother or the world controllers. So, we ought to be on our guard. By the time it's immediately obvious that we the people are technologically outclassed, it may be too late to do anything about it. But let's return to this balance between Huxley's optimism and his pessimism, and see what good he thinks technology could do in the relatively short term. 4. Technology and you. The end of the island reveals a melancholy part of Huxley's vision for the future, and spoiler alert if you are planning on reading the book. The urge to develop at all costs cannot be stopped. The island begins to open its doors to unrestricted industry, and it looks like it too will fall into the dominant narrative of technology for its own sake, regardless of the effects that this might have on the populace. The new constitutional monarch starts selling off the rights to exploit the natural resources of the nation far quicker than the previous government, and they are, ultimately, invaded by a neighbouring dictatorial regime who are invited by that monarch. Despite all his hopes, Huxley does not think that a utopian usage of technology would last. There's something deeply sad about this. This is Huxley's final work, and he is, in effect, saying goodbye to his dream of a society that uses technology and psychology purely for the advantage of the people there. Pala could not survive the imperfect machinations and geopolitics of a fallen world, and so it's trampled under the march of progress. So, what are we to take from this? Has Huxley turned out to be totally anti-technology after all? Well, I would say not. So far, we have been mainly talking in terms of utopia and dystopia, and that is all well and good. But in his essay, Liberty, Quality, Machinery, he gives some more down-to-earth concerns about the future of technology, but also some quite insightful recommendations on how to use it for the betterment of humanity. First of all, Huxley criticizes the idea that modern technology is necessarily ugly or anti-human, responding to critiques that modern building technology necessarily makes uglier structures. Huxley argues that the main difference between the medieval village and the modern city is population size. To quote him directly, "In the small cities of earlier centuries, filth and ugliness surrounded the splendid churches and palaces, but these slums were to be measured in acres, not in square miles." He thus cautions against a knee-jerk reaction of chalking everything peculiarly wrong with our societies to merely technological development. This kind of single explanation will always be an oversimplification, and it won't capture the full breadth of a community's ills. Moreover, Huxley points out that technological advances have allowed people to live longer and led to huge benefits in public health, longevity, and a hell of a lot more. If we abandoned modern technology, all we would do is condemn millions of people to death who rely on that technology for their continued existence, be that in preventing famine or in fighting diseases. I know this sounds like kind of an obvious point, but amongst all the criticism of certain aspects of technology, it's worth acknowledging the huge good it has done and will continue to do. This good is not minor, but affects whole swathes of our lives. For example, in England a century ago, 80 out of every 1,000 children died before their first birthday. Now that number is 4. On the other hand, Huxley is concerned about how governments will use this increasingly sophisticated technology to control us, both with advanced spying and also by appealing to our appetite for distraction and pleasure. I won't dwell on this point too much since we have already discussed it at length, but suffice to say, Huxley doesn't think that this is just a far-off concern relegated to 500 years in the future where Brave New World takes place. It's something to be aware of now. He's also concerned with the increasing capability of technology to just blind us to some of the deeper pleasures and purposes of life, that we will be concerned with the short term to the total expense of the horizon, and that we will become slaves to our moment-to-moment whims, without asking what we really desire out of life and our community. However, this is only one side of the coin. Huxley also points out the great potential victories that could be won regarding both time and capability, and how this could enrich human life if only we learn to harness it. He talks about the machines that could aid us in what he calls art as therapy. That is, we will learn to create as a hobby. As automation increases, there is the real chance that we can devote less and less of our time to work and more to what Aristotle called leisure, that portion of life that is entirely our own and where we can use reason and virtue to determine our fate, rather than be the servant of grim necessity. Here, we can devote our efforts towards creation for creation's sake and stretch our minds for the enjoyment of it, as opposed to any utilitarian purpose in the broad sense of the word. We can use it to become more virtuous and get ever closer to eudaimonia. Huxley is not alone in envisioning this possibility for the future. It was pretty commonplace for people like Russell or Keynes to wax lyrical about outsourcing some of our less pleasant labor to the fortunate unconsciousness of a machine. But Huxley helps us recognize that these benefits are not guaranteed. Technology alone cannot deliver us, but only if it's carefully managed. In some ways, Huxley's worries about modern technology are quite similar to the ones we already have about one of the first major human innovations, the discovery of fire. Fire could warm early humanity through cold nights. It could scare off predators and transform potentially poisonous material into comforting and stomach-filling meals. At the same time, it can burn down dwellings, destroy entire cities, and even kill people in a horrific and painful manner. We could not live without fire, and yet we teach children at a very young age that it's to be both respected and feared. This is even reflected in the myth of Prometheus, who both gives humanity fire and is punished severely for it. If there is a central message to Huxley's account of technology, it's probably this: whatever you do, do not let it go on completely uncritically. Do not end up in a situation where the individual is totally forgotten or made into a gear to turn the wheels of technological progress. Recognize the power of these developments and treat them with the same caution that we would treat any being of great power. But at the same time, don't ignore the countless benefits it may bring, so long as we learn to use it wisely. Regardless of what you think of Huxley's particular ideals or the direction that he wanted humanity to take, I think this is a message well worth listening to. Just like the birds on the island, we can all prompt one another to pay attention. But if you want to explore Huxley's Brave New World in much more detail, then check out my full video on it right here. Thank you so much for watching, and have a wonderful day.